Monticello.
Support comes from Red Cottage, Inc., hand-picked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley. RedCottageInc.com.
From WJFF in Jeffersonville, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Capital Stormers of the Hudson Valley. Two FBI arrests so far and many social media posts attest to a local presence at the D.C. riot and to the viability of right-wing organizing in New York. We'll speak to the reporter from the River Newsroom about Hudson Valley residents connected to the riot. Local sports on hold due to the pandemic, but some might be allowed to practice soon. The Sullivan County Democrats' omnipresent sports podcast team will give us an update. And Jesse Spisato has a profile of the truly incredible, fantastical iron sculptures of local artist Zach Max. And Governor Andrew Cuomo holding a press conference this hour. But first, the news from NPR.
From NPR News, I'm Giles Snyder. Broadcasting legend Larry King has died. King died this morning at a Los Angeles hospital. He was 87. A statement posted to his Twitter feed gives no cause of death, though King was reportedly hospitalized with COVID-19 earlier this month. NPR's Amy Held reports on King's long career.
In a career spanning six decades, thousands of interviews, and his signature suspenders style, Larry King became appointment television. For 25 years, Larry King Live was a regular stop for presidential campaigns, celebrities, and other newsmakers. King left CNN in 2010 and co-founded a production company. Born in Brooklyn in 1933 as Lawrence Zeiger, King began his career as a DJ in Miami, telling NPR broadcasting was in his blood.
I always wanted to do it. When I was a kid, 5-6 years old, I'd listen to the radio, I'd imitate the announcers. I never wanted to be anything else.
In his later years, King suffered a number of health issues, undergoing surgeries for heart attacks and lung cancer. He founded the Larry King Cardiac Foundation to help those without insurance. Amy Held, NPR News.
To Moscow now, where police are detaining people in Pushkin Square amid protests in dozens of Russian cities in support of the jailed Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The BBC's Sarah Rainsford is in Moscow and reports they are pulling mainly young men from the crowd.
Police are circling in packs, swooping on anyone they even suspect is here to support Alexei Navalny. Those people are then dragged quickly towards police vans. Thousands of protesters have been gathering and marching in cities across Russia today, responding to Mr. Navalny's call to resist and protest for the sake of a better Russia and for their own future. The opposition politician, who was first poisoned and is now in custody, could be facing several years in prison. So this day of demonstrations is an important test of how angry Russians are and how ready to make their voices heard.
To China now, exactly a year ago today, the Chinese city of Wuhan went into lockdown. And for the next 76 days, the city's 11 million residents were shut inside their homes to contain the coronavirus pandemic. NPR's Emily Fang spent the last few days in Wuhan to get a sense of the city 1 year on.
A year ago, Wuhan streets were deserted, its hospitals overcrowded. Now life is nearly back to normal, though large gatherings are still forbidden. Many residents are proud Wuhan took strict measures early on. Others are angry about how harsh those measures were. Wuhan is celebrating months without a single new coronavirus case, although dozens of new cases appear in at least three provinces across China. The state has also arrested or vilified anyone with the slightest criticism of China's early mishaps in containing the virus. One blogger, Fang Bin, who documented the early, desperate days of the lockdown, has simply gone missing after being arrested. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
This is NPR. Opening arguments in the Senate impeachment trial of former President Trump will begin the week of February 8th. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced the schedule late yesterday, agreeing to a delay to allow both sides to prepare while the Senate works on cabinet nomination and President Biden's COVID relief package. California's Department of Justice has launched a sweeping civil rights investigation into the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Robert Garofa, member station KPCC, reports.
California Attorney General Javier Becerra said the inquiry comes after credible reports of excessive force, retaliation, and other misconduct at the Sheriff's Department.
It's aimed at identifying and addressing potential systemic violations of the rights of the people of L.A. County.
The inquiry is also a response to what the Department of Justice sees as a lack of sustained oversight of the Sheriff's Department. In a written statement, Sheriff Alex Villanueva welcomed the inquiry. The sheriff has come under fire from critics for a variety of issues, including his approach to deputy discipline, secret deputy cliques, and transparency. For NPR News, I'm Robert Garova.
Canada's foreign minister says it is, the foreign ministry says it's been given consular access to former Canadian diplomat Michael Kovrig. The ministry says officials led by Ambassador Dominic Barton met with Kovrig online this week. Kovrig and a Canadian businessman have been held in China for more than 2 years in a case related to the Chinese telecom giant Huawei. They were detained just days after Canada detained Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou. She is wanted in the U.S. on fraud charges and is fighting extradition. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the ECMC Foundation, working to improve post-secondary educational outcomes for underserved students through evidence-based innovation. Learn more at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. We're awaiting a press conference from Governor Andrew Cuomo. In the meantime, on January 6th, as a throng of Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C., many of the rioters failed to conceal their identities, even while brazenly roaming the halls and even attacking police officers and journalists on the scene. As of this week, research from the Program on Extremism at George Washington University indicates that 117 federal cases plus 27 local ones in D.C. have been filed in connection with the event. New York is among the top three states where defendants hail from, with 8 residents charged thus far. Among the mostly unmasked would-be insurrectionists were at least 3 residents of the Hudson Valley. More locals were present at or otherwise connected to the Capitol storming. Although these individuals may have acted alone, the area has long been targeted for recruitment by fascists. Journalist Arvin Dilawar reported on these individuals in The River, the independent news outlet for the Hudson Valley and Catskill regions, in an article headlined, "Capitol Stormers of the Hudson Valley."
So in recent days, there have been 2 arrests by the FBI within the Hudson Valley. The first one occurred on January 12th. William Joseph Pepe of Beacon was arrested. I believe he's being charged with unlawful entry, although it's common for prosecutors to add more charges once the case actually begins. The second arrest was of Edward Jacob Lang of Newburgh, and that was a few days later on January 16th. Lang is actually being charged with, I'd say, much more serious crimes, which include unlawful entry, but also assault, potentially on a law enforcement officer, and civil disorder. And like I said, more charges may be added by prosecutors, which is not uncommon. Besides that, there's also been some more sort of crowdsourced research into locals who were either at the Capitol that day or were somehow connected to the events. So, for example, Tom Torres is a business owner in Warwick. He owns the Café à la Mode. He was in he was in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, posted a Facebook video from a Washington, D.C. hotel claiming that the violence was not happening, that there was no violence that day, and also that if there was violence against Black Lives Matter supporters, anti-fascist activists, and even Vice President Mike Pence, he himself would have been involved. And the sort of last thing that caught my attention was a Republican State Assembly member from New Windsor, Colin Schmidt, addressed a busload of anti-abortion activists who were on their way to D.C. That same day as well.
No charges or anything against those two folks, though.
No. Torres is just received. Torres and actually his business partner as well, Scott Elephant, are receiving criticism for, you know, their sort of support of what went down in Capitol Hill, as well as some anti-Semitic social media posts which they had previously put up on their Twitter accounts. And Schmidt is receiving criticism for, you know, apparent or allegedly, you know, encouraging the anti-abortion activists who went down. He denies this, and the group that organized the ride, the Orange County Right to Life, also denies that, you know, there was anything wrong with his addressing the group before they left for D.C.
Now, Edward Jacob Lang is formerly of Narrowsburg here in Sullivan County, currently residing in Newburgh. He was arrested for assault, civil disorder, and unlawful entry by the FBI, photographed by journalists from Getty and Reuters and others. And he also extensively documented his participation on his own social media, right?
Yes, absolutely. So as I mentioned in my article, one of the many shocking things about the riot in D.C. was really how brazen some of the participants were. Both Lang and Pepe were documented by photojournalists who were on the scenes. Like, these photojournalists weren't undercover or anything like that. They were very visibly, professional media. Yet, neither Pepe nor Lang felt compelled to wear a mask despite the pandemic and despite the fact that, they were apparently involved in, breaking and entering into a government building. Lang also surprisingly documented his actions on social media, including a video in which a person is seen repeatedly striking police officers. According to a charges document, Lang himself on his Instagram pointed out that this was him. He included like a little arrow and said, "This is me." So it's really quite shocking to, not only commit such violence, but then to like openly take credit for it.
And also shocking locally because he's the son of former Town of Tustin council member Ned Lang, well-known in the community here. Also just shocking in general that people would be doing this and documenting it so brazenly, as you said.
Absolutely. I mean, some critics have pointed out that this is maybe a case of white privilege, openly committing crimes and expecting to get away with it. Others, I think, more succinctly have pointed out that this is actually a case of white power, where these people intentionally intended to subvert the normal democratic processes and thought that they would succeed and there would not only be no consequences, but that there would have actually been a victory over, the election of President Biden.
We mentioned Will Pepe, also arrested by the FBI. He was actually recognized by his co-workers, or the MTA, where he worked in the Metro North train yard in Brewster and turned into the FBI. He's been suspended. Do you know if he's been terminated?
The MTA representative who's interviewed about this mentioned that the agency would probably be suspending him, but I don't know if he's been suspended at this time. I just wanted to mention that Pepe is from Beacon, although he does work in Brewster.
A lot of these things came to light because of social media and people being active to locate and track down these folks and turn them in. One of the groups that was actively involved in the Hudson Valley is the Hudson Valley Anti-Fascist Network. Can you tell us a little bit about who those folks are?
Yeah, absolutely. The Hudson Valley Anti-Fascist Network is a collective of students, workers, and community members who've been monitoring white nationalist activity in the region since 2013. A lot of what they do is sort of online sleuthing, figuring out who these people are, how they're connected to one another, if they're part of any organizations, really mapping out individuals and groups across the valley and, the sort of propagandistic or even violent activities that they participate in. What's somewhat unfortunate is a lot of what the group tries to bring to light is unfortunately ignored by law enforcement. So really what they try to do instead is to educate the public members themselves to understand like what are some sort of like white nationalist, fascist, or other authoritarian far right symbols that might pop up in their community in graffiti or stickers or posters, and how public members can identify these things and, tear them down, report them to the Hudson Valley Anti-Fascist Network so they can continue mapping which areas are really being targeted for sort of fascist recruitment.
In the article, you do mention that Hudson Valley Anti-Fascist Network says that folks are primarily being recruited in the Hudson Valley by something called the Patriot Front. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, some of your listeners might actually be aware of an event that Patriot Front was involved in. That's like the Unite the Right event in Charlotte, Charlottesville, Virginia, in August of 2017, where a young anti-fascist activist, Heather Heyer, was actually murdered by a fascist named James Alex Fields. Following this event, the group that Fields was part of, Vanguard America, decided that because this was so damaging to their image, they would rebrand as Patriot Front. Patriot Front is a fascist organization that tries to couch its rhetoric and its aesthetics in Americana. So they use a lot of language like liberty. They use a lot of red, white, and blue, but they mix it with sort of fascist iconography as well, sort of like, you know, the fascies, the bundle of sticks with an axe on top of it, which is where the, you know, fascists draw their name from. And they particularly have been organizing in the Hudson Valley. The Hudson Valley Anti-Fascist Network, or HFAN, was actually able to recently identify their regional director, Kieran Morris, who lives or used to live in Poughkeepsie. HFAN has since reported that he's sort of been expelled from his home and no longer lives in even New York State. So you can sort of see that there was like this almost concentrated effort by Patriot Front to recruit in the Hudson Valley, and HFAN was able to successfully stop them from continuing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Arvind Dilawar, who's a reporter for the River Newsroom, about his article, Capital Stormers of the Hudson Valley, which talks about some of the folks who stormed the Capitol.
And we're interrupting our conversation with Arvind Dilawar from the River so we can bring you a press conference from Governor Andrew Cuomo. We'll get back to that second half of the interview later. Governor Cuomo just starting his press conference in Brooklyn at a pop-up vaccine site.
And they are in our thoughts and prayers. Hospitalization is 8,802 people. That's actually down 44 from yesterday. And we have 1,500 people who are in ICU, and we have 1,023 people who were intubated. That's where we are today. Let me say this about COVID. I was talking to a group last night. COVID fatigue. Well, we're tired of COVID. We're tired of COVID. It's 329 days. Yeah, I'm tired of COVID. You see these bags? These are not for carrying groceries, these bags. It's been a long 329 days. But this is a war. Think of it like a war. And we've had generations who went to war. And 329 days is not long when you are at war, right? We had generations that spent years at war. Concept of fatigue, well, I'm tired. This is a fight. And when you tire before the enemy tires, you know what happens? The enemy wins. We don't have the luxury of fatigue. We let our guard down. That beast will rise up and will defeat us. There's also a notion that, well, you know, people get sick with COVID, but people survive, so I'm not that afraid of COVID. Don't get cocky with COVID. Don't get cocky with COVID. 144 people died yesterday. Don't get cocky with COVID. The other point about COVID is it created a different dynamic in this country. I call it low tide in America. Last year was low tide in America. Low tide. You go to Shirley Chisholm Park, which is beautiful, which you should go to, and you look at the bay, and you look at the bay at low tide. And at low tide, you see all the ugliness that was on the bottom, right? When the water's up, high tide, it covers everything. Looks beautiful. Low tide, you see all the ugliness on the bottom. We've seen low tide in America and all the ugliness in the bottom. And you know what's on the bottom? Racism, discrimination, inequality. That's what we've seen on the bottom. And it is undeniable. Blacks died at twice the rate of whites from COVID. blacks died at twice the rate of COVID. You can't just go past that fact. How did you have one population die at twice the rate of the white population? Latino population died at 1.5 times the rate of whites. Why? Because low tide, you saw all the racism and discrimination in the system. You saw all the health care disparities, more comorbidities in the black and Latino community. And that's why they died. It's a fact. And it's death. It's not the differential in income. It's not the differential in promotion rate. It's death. It's who lived or who died. We now have a vaccine. The vaccine will save lives. Two issues with the vaccine. Can you get it? And will you take it? Can you get it? That is access. And what happened in COVID testing was, while the black community and Latino community had a higher rate of death, they had a lower rate of COVID testing. Wealthier, whiter communities had more COVID testing. Black communities, poor communities, Latino communities that had a higher death rate had less access to COVID testing. When it comes to this vaccine, access has to be fair all across the board. We're working with 300 churches to distribute the vaccine. We're working with public housing authorities all across the state. We're going to do every NYCHA senior development in the city of New York. All 33 will have access. So we will break our hiney. Hiney is a technical governmental term, H-I-N-E-Y. It's an acronym. Someday I'll explain it to you what it means. We will get the access. Our bigger problem is the acceptance, especially among the black and Latino community. Why? Because they're skeptical. They're skeptical of a vaccine approved by the Trump administration. A Trump administration that seemed highly political, that politicized health care, that made political decisions rather than scientific decisions. And then the Trump administration says, this is a safe vaccine. And people say, I don't believe you. By the way, I don't trust the Trump administration. I'm cynical about the Trump administration. I wouldn't just believe the Trump administration. And I know the Trump administration. That's why we had a second panel of New York doctors review the vaccine. I'm not taking the Trump administration's word for it. We set up our own panel, best doctors, not only in this state, in this country. They reviewed the vaccine. They said it's safe. I believe in the vaccine. My mother is going to take the vaccine. My mother is 65 plus. She doesn't like when I say she's 65 plus. I said, Mom, I'm 63. How can you not be 65 plus? What am I giving away? Mathematically, people can figure that out. My mother's 65 plus. She's going to take the vaccine. My daughters, who I love more than life itself, they're going to take the vaccine. I'm going to take the vaccine. There's no politics here. My mother and my daughters, I would not let take the vaccine unless I believed it was safe. It is safe. Yes, the black community in particular has reasons to be skeptical. Yes, there's racism. Yes, there's discrimination. Yes, there was the Tuskegee experiment. You can't explain that away. There are no apologies. But that's not the case with this vaccine. Take the vaccine. It will save lives, and it can save your life. We know blacks have a higher infection rate. We know they're more essential workers. They're more exposed to it. Please take the vaccine. We'll make it accessible, but we need you to accept it. And that's what we're here to do today. Somos is going to run a vaccination site here. We're going to be doing it in public housing all across the city, all across the state. But we need people to accept the vaccine. With that, let me turn it over to the general of SOMOS. I can't thank him enough. He's gone all over the country with us, Georgia, other states. He's been working in Black and Latino communities all across this state. And talk about saving lives. Henry Munoz has saved lives. Henry Munoz, thank you.
I think that your understanding of what we're going through and who we are is why in our clinics across the city, we hear your name, but when they call your name, they call you Governor Andres Cuomo, because you've earned their respect. You're one of the few elected officials in this country that people still trust, and they believe in you because of what you've done, and I want you to know how appreciative we are for being one of us. That's what SOMOS means. It means we are, means we're together. You know, first of all, I want to thank the people who live here at William Reed for welcoming us into their home this morning and for allowing us to be here and to come back when we're needed to vaccinate the people who need this vaccination the most. This is an unusual for my colleagues and the people of SOMOS. This is who we are. We live here. These are the places that we returned to after we got tested. Our families live here, our grandparents, our abuelos and our abuelas. We come to visit them here. I'm reminded of my own grandmother this morning, Doña Julia Molina, who I must have been doing something wrong. She sat me down on a Saturday morning just like this, and she said, "Dime con quién andas y te diré quién eres," which means, tell me who you walk with and I'll tell you who you are. From March the 5th, when Governor Cuomo spoke to hundreds of doctors in the SOMOS network and asked us to join the army to fight this virus, we have gone wherever we've been asked to go. We have set up testing sites in parking lots and churches and schools and colleges and universities in places just like this to get the testing to people so that we could understand the impact of this virus on our communities. We have, hard to believe, but we have fed millions of people over the course of this pandemic, and we've opened up our clinics at dangerous moments to our own staff without vaccinations and lost over a dozen of our own people to this virus. But we've never really hesitated to be a part of the effort that you have created. And we're here in this complex today, this home to people, and we are opening up other vaccination sites in NYCHA and in churches and larger scale places where we know that we can bring access to the people who need it the most and who will listen to the trusted voices in their community who are the doctors and nurses that have always taken care of them and their families and their children. We know that we can play a role in this war. We are deputized as your infantry because we think that we can have a real impact on the state's effort to vaccinate New York and to bring this, what we call...
All right, we've been listening to a press conference from Governor Andrew Cuomo. He's at a pop-up vaccination site in Brooklyn with the vaccine supplies perilously low. They're showing that they do have some vaccines and will actually be vaccinating some folks, not taking questions today. He did announce that hospitalizations have ticked down to 8,802. There have been 144 deaths, and the positivity rate is 5.26%. This is Radio Chatskill. Let's get back to the conversation with journalist Arvind Dilawar. He wrote an article called Capital Stormers of the Hudson Valley for The River, the independent news outlet for the Hudson Valley and Catskill regions. We were talking about some of the local individuals who stormed the Capitol. And when we took the governor's press conference, we were talking about the Patriot Front, a group that's been targeting the area for recruitment with fascism. What are some of the things that folks can look for? You mentioned also that the propaganda from the Patriot Front is a way that the Hudson Valley Anti-Fascist Network identifies and helps map where folks are. I mean, we mentioned Charlottesville, but we're talking about our own backyards. What should folks look for? What can they look for?
Yeah, so really what's been happening over the last couple of years in terms of fascist recruitment has primarily been through posters, stickers, graffiti, things like this. There's like some iconography that might be familiar to people. The sort of like, as I mentioned, Patriot Front uses a lot of Americana, so like red, white, and blue, but they'll mix it with more traditional fascist icons, like the fascies, a bundle of sticks with like a axe on top of it. I think keeping an eye out for stuff like that. There's other stuff that is like maybe not as openly fascist, but still far right, such as 3%ers stuff, which typically is like a circle of stars with like the Roman numeral 3 in the middle. These things are put up not only as a recruitment to try to draw mostly young white men into these organizations, but also as a way to sort of intimidate others who understand what they mean. So to say that, you know, there are fascists around here, there are white supremacists around here, you are not safe here if you're a person of color, if you're part of the queer community, if you, you know, identify as an anti-fascist. So looking out for these things, I think, is the first thing that's extremely important. HVN actually has a step-by-step tutorial, a sort of like guide that they distribute in the community to help folks recognize these threats and properly counter them. And what they recommend to that end is, you know, first and foremost, take this stuff down. If it's not up, it can't recruit, it can't intimidate people. So taking it down is important. They recommend doing this in groups just to make sure that you're safe. They recommend doing this with a tool like a glass scraper, because unfortunately, fascists have been known to put razor blades sometimes behind posters or stickers. So when, you know, unsuspecting people try to remove them, they'll like, you know, cut their fingers. Unfortunately, there was also one case where I believe it was in Colorado. Someone was removing fascist propaganda, was spotted by a fascist and actually stabbed. So that's why they also recommend, HVN recommends doing this sort of work in groups. But yeah, I think, you know, it's having that awareness and having that commitment to not let this continue in our own backyards, because unfortunately local law enforcement has not been as proactive as some of us might imagine they would be in, you know, such a frightening situation.
In your article, you mentioned that the FBI is definitely taking the threat of fascist violence seriously, but that local law enforcement may not be, at least in a few incidents. There were a few incidents in Beacon where people tore down some of these flyers. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, generally speaking, the FBI has been better than local law enforcement about this. I believe it was almost a decade ago, the FBI was actually reporting that they fear many local law enforcement agencies have white nationalist sympathies or have actual white nationalist members as part of the department. But the two recent arrests that we've seen in the Hudson Valley, both were done by the FBI. Unfortunately, local law enforcement, like Beacon Police Department, for example, has taken the situation much less seriously. In Beacon, there was actually an instance of Patriot Front postering up and down Main Street very brazenly in January of 2019. Two residents of Beacon sort of took it upon themselves to tear down all of the posters, and they reported this to the Beacon Police Department, who really said that there was nothing they could do. This was all reported by a little Beacon blog. Sort of shows you, like, you know, to what degree the police are even interested in being involved in stopping this before it really gets started.
How big are the numbers of these groups, and how dangerous are they?
You know, like one HVN activist who I spoke to said, there are not many formal members of these organizations. Like, for example, you know, they estimate that Patriot Front maybe only has like a handful, maybe like probably less than a dozen members in the Hudson Valley. The danger is not necessarily that they are so numerous. I think the danger is that they are committed to violence. I mentioned Charlottesville, Virginia. It was only one fascist who, you know, killed one person there and injured 28 others when he drove his vehicle into a crowd of people. So I think that's one aspect of the danger, is that it only takes one person to commit a horrific amount of violence. I think the other real danger is that when we have events like the Capitol Hill riot bringing together these desperate elements of the far right, such as anti-abortion activists, such as Oath Keepers, such as like Patriot Front members, it makes it easy for them to recruit amongst themselves. So someone walks into the space being a pro-Trump supporter and they walk out being a white nationalist. We can sort of see how this happened in the photos and videos from the riot itself, where you, if you look closely, you can see people wearing like Camp Auschwitz t-shirts, standing alongside people who are dressed in like, you know, red, white, and blue. The fact that these open neo-Nazis are not even being pushed out of these spaces, but are actually actively collaborating and openly collaborating, really illustrates the danger that they might be a few in number today, but the potential for them to grow tomorrow is very real. And they themselves understand this and are actively trying to infiltrate, quote unquote, pro-Trump groups to push them further to the right.
Do you think that now that we've had the peaceful transition of power, that these groups in the Hudson Valley will stay quiet for a while? Or do you think that this might just energize them to commit more acts of violence?
I think both the research and, like, you know, long-time investigation of these sort of phenomenon suggests that they actually increase under Democratic administrations. For example, the militia movement really took off during Bill Clinton's terms. I think this helps them in a weird way because it solidifies they are being oppressed. Look at these Democrats. They're taking away our rights. And what that does is allow more fringe elements of the far right, such as white nationalists, neo-Nazis, other fascists, to appeal to what in another case might just be someone who considers themselves a Republican. If the fascists are able to construe the situation as being an emergency, a question of life or death, suddenly they're much more easy. It's much more easy for them to find recruits.
We mentioned that the main group that we seem to be targeting folks for recruiting is the Patriot Front. Are there other groups that have formed after the violence at the Capitol, or that have been around?
It's interesting because I haven't seen anything since the Capitol riot itself. One thing that was a little troubling while I was researching this article is one group called Loud Majority, which just describes itself as a pro-Trump organization. The Hudson Valley section was founded by a Walden resident, Eric Oberpriller. They sort of came to the defense of the owners of Cafe a la Mode, who, as I mentioned, one was in Washington, D.C. on January 6th and mentioned that he would like to be part of some violence against Black Lives Matter supporters, anti-fascist activists, and even Vice President Mike Pence. Loud Majority came to this person's defense even after they had sort of made this statement, and even after it was found that they had posted anti-Semitic content on their social media accounts. So I think there's other groups who are still ready to make themselves known and ready to, like, even defend perhaps, like, what happened in D.C. Patriot Front, for example, I haven't heard anything much about them locally. There are other groups that are around, such as Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, the Proud Boys, who are pretty openly involved in Washington, D.C., and I believe two of their members, two of their leaders have already been arrested or are facing charges. But yeah, unfortunately, they're not one big cohesive group. There are a lot of small groups who, you know, may have slightly different politics, but as we saw in D.C., are willing to work together.
Based on what you've uncovered, do you think there will be more arrests that are tied back to the Hudson Valley?
I think the FBI themselves have said the number of charges are increasing and they expect them to go up. So New York, unfortunately, is, I think, within the top three states of, you know, four defendants who are being charged. So I would be very surprised if we didn't find more people, unfortunately, from the Hudson Valley who were involved.
Arvind Dilawar is an independent journalist. His articles, interviews, and essays have appeared in Newsweek, The Guardian, and Vice, among others. His current reporting is in The River. It's called Capital Stormers of the Hudson Valley, and you can find it at theRiverNewsroom.com. Arvind, thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
This is Radio Chatskill. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, a conversation with the artist Zach Max. We'll be right back.
On this week's On the Media, journalists learned plenty of lessons in the Trump era.
For example, what the president says is news. By obeying that convention, journalists cooperated in their own demise.
But which lessons will stick on this week's On the Media from WNYC?
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we looked forward to putting all the partisan fighting behind us and moving on to the really important issues.
I now must know, what does a badger smell like?
I'm Peter Sagal. We can't help with the badgers, but we will explore actor Mandy Patinkin's remarkable beard. Join us for the news quiz from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. A monster named Big Ed, sculptures of gargoyle-looking creatures, heads of lettuce, and trippy, drippy heads all decorating open land throughout the Catskills. These are the life-size metal sculptures from the imagination of artist Zach Max. Contributor Jesse Sposato spoke to Zach about the themes of chaos and absurdity that infiltrate his work.
If you're anything like me, you've probably noticed these larger-than-life, fantastical sculptures in Sullivan County at some point and wondered what they were all about. You know the ones I'm talking about. They're made of metal, they look like something Tim Burton or Maurice Sendak might have dreamed up, and you can find them hanging out in the town center of Rock Hill, on various lawns around the county, and more. The maker behind these quirky, lovable creatures is metal sculptor Zach Shavrick, better known as Zach Max, and the list of people who own his work includes Snoop Dogg, Ice Cube, Ozzy Osbourne, and possibly soon you. I spoke to him about how he first got into sculpting, the state of his studio when he's working, and what he's been making during the pandemic. Here's our conversation.
So I just wanted to ask you some like background logistical questions first. Where do you live and do you have your studio like in your house or is it somewhere else?
Currently, I live in Youngsville, New York, in between Liberty and Jeffersonville. And I am working in a little studio that's part of a building that's not attached to my house. So I have a little studio barn, but it's got a little part of it dedicated to my current workspace. But I've worked for many years at my dad's property, which I lived on all my life, and that's in Ferndale, so not far from here either. Mm-hmm. So, and then I also jump around to different shops whenever I need to do larger stuff.
Totally. You don't live in that house on 52 that has your sculptures on it, do you?
I do.
Oh, amazing. cool. And is sculpting what you do for a living, or do you also have a day job?
No, that's all I've ever done. It's just sculpting for a living.
Yeah, so good.
I mean, I've had jobs here and there recently, just since the COVID stuff happened. But other than that, you know, it's been only sculpting.
Cool. Well, I've read a lot about, I feel like a lot of the interviews I read have similar information. So I don't want to be too redundant, but I read that you've been sculpting with metal since you were 5. Can you tell me a little bit about how you got into it and sort of what you like about sculpting with metal?
Well, my father, he was doing it since I was born. He was even doing it before I was born. And
right.
When I was born, he actually became more of a full-time sculptor. So he went from doing traditional ironwork to being a full-time sculptor and just being at home sculpting all the time. And so I would just go into the shop with him and hang out with him when I was home from school or when I was after school. Anytime that there was time available, I'd be in the shop working with him and making stuff on my own. And he'd be helping me set it up, or I'd figure out how to do it in my own ways. And, you know, I just never stopped. That was sort of that became my life.
Amazing. Do you still work with your dad to this day?
I do. I do. Not as much as he'd like, but I do work with him. Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. And how would you describe your work to someone who's never seen it before? I feel like it's very specific. And I think of your sculptures as very sort of like demonic looking, kind of scary little guys.
Yeah, for sure. I make like creatures and demons and monsters and, you know, just pretty wild beasts. And right now I'm working on a whole series of animated slugs. So, nice. You know, just little crazy kind of things. There's a whole genre in that realm, you know, the lowbrow art world. So I think that's sort of where it falls.
Gotcha. And like, is that what your sculptures were always like when you first started making, you know, sculptures that were sort of like your own? Or did you ever have a different style at some point?
Nope. I think I tried to make sculptures like my dad's because he does abstract artwork like a couple times when I was a kid. And I was like, no, this isn't for me. I can't do it. Like, I could do it, but I don't want to do it. I want to do this exact thing. And that's all I ever did. And so I just refined it, you know?
Yeah. Like, where did your style first come from? And do you remember when you felt like, oh, this is like my style? Like when you had a, you know, I don't know, a hold on it kind of?
I was really young because I feel like I'm still locked into certain decisions I made culturally as a very little child, of really liking Kenny Scharf, famous artist. Kenny Scharf was like, he was probably my number one influence as a little kid. And I became kind of obsessed with him for my like really young years. And I went to the Tony Schifrazzi Gallery in the city, which is where he was represented for most of his career. And so Kenny Scharf is a pop artist from the Andy Warhol Basquiat era. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, he's making a very big resurgence these days and has a clothing line with Dior, which I think is really cool. So I'm pretty psyched to hear that. So that's pretty cool.
But awesome.
Yeah, so he went into a time where I became taught by another guy named J.J. Varonis, who's another huge influence of mine. And was like a sort of underground graffiti artist, but doing it in metal. So He was in the graffiti world, but he was trying to do his own version of it with steel. So he would create street signs and sculptures that he would put up and you could find all over the place, just sort of in the world. It was pretty cool.
Do you primarily make work and then sell it to like kind of whoever's interested, or do you more often work on commission?
It's a mixture of both. Definitely, that's my entire livelihood is based on one or the other of those.
Right.
And it all depends on, you know, the season or, you know, what's working, what's not. So sometimes I have a big commission that will take up my entire focus for a year or two.
Wow.
And then sometimes I'll have, you know, just little stuff that will, you know, I'll be marketing here and there.
Yeah, totally. And how many sculptures do you sort of keep for yourself? Obviously, I know that there are a few on your lawn. Do you have them like all over your house, all over your studio?
I mean, usually I don't keep around too many sculptures. At the moment, I have lots and lots of these little slug creatures, which I've been making one a day of for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And just those. And I always have a couple big sculptures around that are mine as well. So those are dotted, not just around my property, but other locations where they're still mine. So there's that. And then, yeah, just a handful. It's not overly chaotic with my own stuff, but I have a certain inventory around.
Cool. And I've seen quite a few of your sculptures kind of around Sullivan County. I feel like you're very prolific. Do you have any idea how many works you make in like a month or a year or?
Well, you know, it depends on the month and the year.
Sure.
So right now I'm probably making more per month than normal because I'm making lots of these little slugs. And sometimes I'll go in the shop and I'll make six or seven in like a, I don't know, a 20-minute period or a couple hours period. And, you know, that adds to the number of sculptures I've created. But then I'll also sometimes spend a lot of time to make one.
Yeah. I mean, how long does it take you to make one of the bigger sculptures that you make? Like those Rock Hill guys, the band that you have made in Rock Hill. Like, how long does it take to make something like that?
You know, one of them came out. I finished it in 2 months flat, and another one took 6 months. And
oh, wow.
So it really ranges between the pieces and what, you know, as far as exact time of work that goes into it, it probably is only about a month's worth of work, but mm-hmm. it's broken up into the design phases and, you know, the planning phases. And then there's all the different parts that go into it. So,
can you tell me a little bit more about that process? Like, where do you start and how long is sort of each of those phases, or like, what does that entail?
I can't really go into it too much. It's just sort of a natural process, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, if I broke it down, it might take longer than the process itself to figure out in my own head. And I don't know. It's like, I don't do tons of initial sketches unless I'm required to. And usually I'll give a single sketch, and if it's approved, then I won't usually make too many more sketches except for a couple references for myself mm-hmm. while I'm in the middle of working on it. And when I was younger, I always started with an armature. So I would make a framework for the sculpture and then build into that. But as I've gotten older, I've preferred to work without the armature and just kind of let the metal and the process take a little bit of control. But as far as the whole steps of the other parts, you know, it's hard to say given on the commission, given on what the customer wants. You know, sometimes you get a problem in the middle of the sculpture where they want to see pictures of it in process, and people don't always get the final product in their head the same as what I have. And, mm-hmm. you know, coming to that middle point is sort of what takes the most time. When people are really, you know, like, do whatever you want, that's usually when I produce my best work, right. You know, because then you don't have to combine what you have in your mind with what you think they want in their mind. It's just what you want. And that always will be, you know, something personal and usually will come out the best for it. So when I try and, you know, get a commission or something, I usually focus my commissions in that realm.
So you wouldn't necessarily start with like drawing something every time. If you're just doing it from like your imagination, you just kind of go.
Oh yeah. When I go in the shop these days, I'll make 3-4 slugs that I never drew, and they'll just pop up based on, you know, that moment. Sometimes I'll try and make the exact same one and it will come out 100% different.
No. Right. Totally. That's awesome. And who are your sculptures to you? Like, especially the ones that you make that aren't commissioned. I see that some of them have names. Do you name them all, or do you kind of like imagine what their personalities are like?
There's definitely personality in all of them. And that's the goal. And I, you know, I've been working on animations, and I'm trying to push that further and further. And my current project, which I'm still in the writing phase for, but I do hope to do a little movie with all of these slugs, like a feature length movie, or, you know, maybe I shoot for a feature length and I hit 15 minutes and I'm happy.
Right.
The point is, I'm trying to make a long little movie with these characters and give them all like slight personalities. They don't have to just be, you know, fully fleshed out characters, but, you know, let them show through as characters in a TV show or a movie.
Cool. Yeah. Do you feel like a lot of the guys that you've created are kind of like part of the same world and maybe even work in conversation with each other? Or do you think of them as more separate?
No, for sure. They're all from the same, same world.
Cool. And what is your actual working process like technically? Like, do you have a messy studio? Do you work with music on? I feel like you responded to one of my emails at 3 a.m. I take it you're a night person.
Well, you know, that's that's what happens when the wife goes on vacation. So.
Nice.
So, but no, my studio is pretty messy, but I am always hoping to make it cleaner than it is. It's just part of the nature of having a small studio and so much stuff kind of crowded in there. And when I am working, part of the process is going to be making a mess. So if you like came in the middle of a sculpture, I wouldn't even attempt to clean up because the mess is part of it. You know, I'll take a bucket full of scrap and I'll just flip it over and use every piece that I take out of that bucket. But by flipping the bucket over, that exposes all the scrap that was in that bucket and makes it easier for me to just like move through it quicker. So some of the mess is, yeah, it's just functional mess.
What has it been like to work during COVID? I feel like this time period for artists is either like a dream or kind of a nightmare.
Yeah, it definitely has felt like a point where I can allow for extra creativity. You know, I don't have to, I don't have as much going on. So it's sort of like whenever you're given a situation where you have the opportunity to think about certain things that you wouldn't normally be given that chance. Like, I guess COVID has that effect, and I just, you gotta take advantage of it when it's there, you know, sleep when you can.
Well, this has been really great to talk. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you wanted to add? Anything that's like instrumental to your ethos or any, what you like about working in Sullivan County?
I guess I'm here, so that makes it convenient. But I've enjoyed working all over the world. I don't know if Sullivan County is particularly better than anywhere else, but it is my home, and you know, I have a lot of friends here and a lot of people I care about, and I guess that's how it works in this world sometimes.
To see Zach's work without having to drive around Sullivan County looking for it, go to ZachMax.com and check out his Twitch stream at twitch.tv/ZachMax. And also, you should totally drive around Sullivan County looking for Zach's sculptures. They're pretty amazing.
That's Jesse Spisato with a conversation with artist Zach Max. Earlier, we planned to bring you an excerpt of the new Sullivan County Democrat podcast called Omnipresent Sports with sports editor Joe Abraham and sports reporter Richard Ross, where they discuss the current state of local sports during the pandemic. We will not be able to bring that to you today because we brought you part of the Governor Andrew Cuomo's press conference. We will have them back, though, in the future. Meanwhile, news yesterday, New York State released new guidance Friday, which now allows high-risk high school sports to resume on February 1st. The new guidance says teams can resume individual or distanced group training as well as no or low contact group training. This includes high school sports like football, wrestling, and basketball. And you can find a link to the Omnipresent Sports podcast from Joe and Richard on the Sullivan County Democrats Facebook page. And that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Remember, be kind, wear a mask, and stop the spread. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Red Cottage, Inc., hand-picked vacation rentals located throughout the Catskills and Hudson Valley. RedCottageInc.com.
WJFF, Jeffersonville, New York, W233AH, Monticello.
This is Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country. Join us Saturday mornings at 11 for WJFF's locally produced radio show relating to life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. Tune in to 90.5 FM, stream us live, or listen to the archive on our website, wjffradio.org. See you Saturday, just after Radio Chatskill and before Catskill Character.
And Rosie's coming up next. And then we've got Janice Adams after Catskill Character and Josh Fox at 1 o'clock, all locally produced here at Radio Catskill, your public radio station. Today's forecast, windy today and through tomorrow, wind gusts up to 30 miles an hour, making a wind chill. Temperatures feel like zero today and negative five tonight and tomorrow. Today's high predicted around 20, tonight's low officially 13, and tomorrow sunny with a high of 25.
Support for Farm and Country comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, a community-supported, science-based nonprofit, taking legal actions, providing tools for action, and raising awareness of fracking damage since 2008, proactively protecting public health in the Delaware River Basin and beyond. DamascusCitizens.org.